Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is not a diving podcast. Scuba.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not a Diving Podcast. This week on the show, there's no guest. I noticed that there's been 20 weeks pretty much. Yeah, in fact, 19 guests and so 20 weeks since I last did a recap kind of solo pod. And it's kind of interesting to do these occasionally, I'm finding. Or rather, I found the last one interesting, and I think it will be interesting to do on today. Just to kind of go over what we've talked about over the last 19 shows, how things have developed, like the themes that have emerged, because I never really have a set plan, like an overall strategy, as it were. I kind of have my tactical battle plan for each episode, but I don't get a chance to think too broadly about where we're going. So it's good to go back over things and just assess what we've covered and assess what's come out of it and how we might attack the next few episodes going forward. Now, this is also in the context of me spending a weekend in Berlin last weekend, which was also the context of the last update, kind of a pod that we did. So we had a show, a hot flush show at Arden. And we also did on the Saturday, so that was on the Friday, and on the Saturday we did Her live stream, Hot Flush Presents at Her. That's the one with the bathroom, for those of you who are not aware. So for both of those shows, we had Anna Kost playing, Closet Yee, who had come in from South Korea. Actually, she'd been in Europe for a few weeks, but yeah, she was on the last leg of a trip from there, which is the first time I think she's been over playing proper shows. She's been over before, but it was her first proper run, really, as an artist doing the touring thing. And at the Arden show, we had Appleblim playing back-to-back with Roska. And then on Her, Roska just played on his own. Additionally to me, of course, doing my thing too. So it was kind of a... It was a fun weekend, a bit different to my last trip there where I, if you listen to episode 15 of the pod, where I described clearing out the dance floor of a Berlin club. So it's a bit different to that, but it's always a bit different when it's your show. So yeah, the weekend was a lot of fun. I had a chance to walk around the city in certain areas, which I hadn't been for a long time, which was a really strange experience, I have to say. So when I first moved over, I've realized that I've said on basically every episode that I moved to Berlin in 2007. I hear myself saying it on these episodes. I'm thinking, oh God, this must be so boring. But it was kind of a pivotal moment in my life, really, because it was just at the point that I was able to start doing music for a living. So moving over from London was heavily financially motivated. I quit my day job and decided just to go ahead and make music in a place where there was a really great scene, but crucially it was much, much cheaper to live than in London. So anyway, I moved to an area called Friedrichshain, and I lived for the first few years that I was there on a street called Boxhagener Straße, and I was able to walk around that area for the first time in a long, long time. So I eventually left the city in end of 2014. But the last few years I was living in Neukölln, and I didn't go back a lot to hang in Friedrichshain. So I walked around there. And, it's a truism about Berlin that it's constantly changing, and it's changed so much. and everyone says that about it. And I guess it's just obvious since the state that it was in when the wall came down was such that, you know, it was going to be, well, the process of development was going to be sort of constant. And, you know, it's taken this long for it to really start resembling a proper, quote unquote, proper German city. So 30 years or more, just over 30 years, for it to kind of feel like somewhere which is no longer a kind of work in progress, I guess. But anyway, I was able to walk around Friedrichshain, and, you know, Friedrichshain was one of the places, one of the early places, I guess, to become quote unquote cool in that, in the kind of post wall coming down era. So like Mitte, I think, was the first place, and then Prenzlauberg, and then Friedrichshain. But Friedrichshain was always the place that was kind of the center of the kind of punk left wing, the kind of May Day riots, which are always a big thing in Berlin, and were always centered actually around Boxhagnerplatz. That was what I learned when I moved into Friedrichshain for the first time. Like, that was, it was always like, yeah, on May Day, this place is going to kick off. And it definitely did kick off on numerous occasions when I was living there. Like, the May Day thing is really, it's really a big deal in Germany, in Berlin in particular. And yeah, there was definitely some burning cars and that sort of thing going on, which is, you know, it's fine. People got to make their point. And the 1st of May is as good a time to do it as any, I guess. But yeah, I was walking around there, and it was, it's funny because it's so the same, but also like palpably different. So it's one of those things where, like, I just was walking down the streets, and like the people who look the same and dress the same but are just younger and ostensibly, you know, are just basically the same people, you know, to all intents and purposes. And it struck me, what really struck me as I was sort of making that observation in the moment, was that that is what culture is. That's the culture of a place making its mark on people and, you know, influencing them to act in a certain way, basically. So to dress in a certain way and to behave in a certain way. And that's so interesting to me because it's 15 years or so apart. And like that sort of punk aesthetic is, you know, 45 years old at this point or more. And there's all sorts of discussion about what punk is and what punk means. But I mean, you know, it's recognizable as a style, like outwardly, as an aesthetic. And I guess as an attitude, I guess that's the thing that people put their finger on most. I think people who are clued up about it, probably. But it was anyway, very, very noticeable to me that Friedrichshain is still very much of its own thing in its own son of a way. But, you know, the way that the city has changed even since I left, like, so for example, like the main station closest to where I used to live is Warschaustrasse, and there's this enormous shopping mall been built right outside the station across the road. And that part of that area when I moved over was just it was just vacant lots. And the first thing they built there when I was living there was the arena. I forget what it's called, but it's like, I think it's still sponsored by Mercedes these days, but it's like, it's just dreadful kind of sports / live events arena. The only thing I've ever been to see there was Roger Waters doing The Wall, which I got a ticket for because, well, I just got a ticket for it through someone. And I am a Pink Floyd fan, but my God, that was a bad show. I left halfway through. I've never left halfway through a show before in my life. And it was, yeah. Anyway, less said about that, the better. But I guess it was a reflection of the venue that it was in, to be honest, because I mean, that is an eyesore, to say the least, that venue. And this shopping mall that they've built called the East Side Mall is just, I mean, it's appalling. It really is bad. And it's like they've just at the moment that shopping malls become obsolete, they've built one. And it just seems to me that like the outlook that's been taken towards developing the city is just not a good one, really, at all. And it speaks to, I guess, the influence of corporate money and all the rest of it, but which is just, you know, inevitable. But yeah, it's bad. It's really bad. But more pertinently to the show, there were other changes that I noticed and things that are the same too, but other challenges that I noticed, like just putting on a night in the city. And, you know, when I started doing this podcast, I wanted to avoid talking about the pandemic as much as possible. But it's inevitable, unfortunately, to put it in that context, to put changes to particularly live events in that context. And that also has an implication for music as well. I mean, the two things are obviously fundamental to each other. But I mean, like the changes in particularly the live space that we've talked about in recent episodes, for example, with Ned Beckett on last week's episode, but also with Rich McGinnis and also Nicole Cacciavillano, you know, and their experiences running parties. Like, it's obviously something which has been, you know, the defining event of the last few years. So putting on a night in Berlin traditionally, and my experience of this is I've got a fair amount of experience putting on parties in Berlin. So, I mean, you'll have heard me, if you listened to previous episodes, you will have heard me talking about the substance parties that we did at Berghain. And those were a little bit different because we weren't really the promoters as such. So we were really just consulting on the lineup. So we picked the lineups, and the Berghain in-house promotion team would basically do the work of selling the show, really, as it were. I mean, obviously, I was the kind of quote-unquote front man for it as an artist. And, you know, there are certain things you have to do, if that's you, to sell an event. But, you know, we were not promoters in this sort of like traditional sense for those shows. But we used to do hot flush parties at a venue called Horst in Kreuzberg, which was an awesome venue run by a guy called Johnny, who used to work at Trezor and various other places. So we used to do those pretty regularly, every couple of months, I think we did them. And the kind of defining feature of putting on shows in Berlin, as I say shows, it's not even shows, it's the wrong way of putting it. Parties is the terminology. The defining feature is the fact that people go out so late, certainly compared to being used to the kind of UK way of doing things. Like, people will not get to a club under any circumstances before 2 a.m. in Berlin, and even that is seen as being pretty early. Certainly that was my experience of it. But at our party on Friday, this weekend, like, there were people there from, I mean, the doors opened at 11, which I was surprised about anyway, but there were people there for, like, there was a reasonable dance floor from midnight, and that blew my mind, I have to say. And when you've got people in from early, it really has a effect on how you've programmed the night. So if you've got a few DJs, which we did, we had, you know, four acts basically playing, and it was basically 2 hour sets. Like, if you expect it to be empty for the entirety of the first DJ set, like, that is a bit of a change when you've got people there and dancing. So one of the kind of phenomena of recent times, and this has been discussed on Twitter, argued over on Twitter, is how you should approach a warm-up set these days, and whether the new generation of DJs gives proper respect to the institution of the warm-up set, and the implication being that they don't at all. And, you know, the tempo of music has definitely moved up a lot. Certainly what the kind of tempo expectations, I guess, of the audience have increased substantially. And, you know, it was it occurred to me during the DJ who played first on Friday, during her set, she was playing like around 135 BPM. And, you know, an older friend of mine came up to me and was like, wow, this is extremely fast for early in the night. but it occurred to me that it really depends on where you expect it to end up. So if you expect the peak time DJ to be around about 150, then 135 is completely reasonable to play during warm up. but, you know, even 5 years ago, 150, don't be ridiculous. You couldn't play 150. Even if you're playing pretty hard. So just the expectations have changed to such a large extent, such a huge degree, that I think it changes people's, the way they view those early sets. Anyway, so that was one thing. And The other was, well, I mean, I won't say too much about where the actual party panned out. It was a really fun night. I had a great time. But if I'd known how the crowd was going to, well, if I'd known when people were going to arrive, I would have programmed it a bit differently, put it that way. And it made me think about those kind of comments about warm-up sets and, you know, the extent to which the kind of classical notion of building a party, I guess, from the kind of promoter's perspective, like, you know, it's a real kind of a fine art putting a party together and, you know, creating the environment for people to have a good time. And the programming of the music is absolutely central to that. Particularly if you're, you know, if you've got a big lineup of, and you're wondering where to put people, like the running order, it's really super significant, you know. And we've talked on the show about, you know, the tradition of all night sets. We talked about that to Dubfire in relation to the classic kind of New York scene and that kind of tradition of one DJ playing all night, and you know that kind of skill of building like the atmosphere from very early on, knowing when to boost the system, you know, knowing when to drop the first vocal, all those kinds of like little details which can make memorable moments happen on a dance floor, memorable moments happen in a party. And as I said, the respect is apparently not paid anymore to the extent that it should be to warm-up sets. And that says a lot about the way people think about parties generally. Like, it's like, you know, have those details been lost a bit in the way that people think about it? If the attitude of every DJ is to come in and just play as hard as they can, like, do some of those nuances get lost? And, you know, you'd have to say on the face of it, yes, they do. And it turns into something different, right? Because, you know, that all night long thing, which is very much kind of like house and techno, but more kind of very much a kind of house attitude, is so different to the kind of bass music attitude of like 1 hour sets. And, you know, the classic drum and bass thing of like every, you know, you've got 8 hour party, 8 DJs, and everyone turns up and plays their bangers. And it's sort of it's kind of arms race, a tuned arms race, right? So you have to do just the most with your set as possible. And I guess the kind of DJs that stood out in those environments, those kind of like DJ environments, the scenes, the DJs that stood out were the ones that were able to do something different in and distinctive basically in those conditions, right? So I'm thinking about like DJ Hype, for example, with his scratching thing, and I guess when Andy C started doing double drops and that kind of stuff, to really kind of distinguish themselves from everyone else. And that, you know, that's a creative thing, you know, there's a lot to be said for that, you know. And parameters, constraints, I've often said over the years, can be extremely motivating and extremely inspiring, right? So it's not necessarily a bad thing to have these impositions. And it's also an extremely easy thing to sort of shake your head at a new development, such as the potential ignoring of cherished party norms. Anyway, so basically, long way of saying that we had a great night on Friday, but it was a bit different to what I was thinking it was. And, you know, I don't know. These are just observations, extremely subjective observations. And I've been trying to figure out what, if any, the big changes have been, you know. And just going back to what I mentioned at the top, was I was hoping to get out of this discussion, because I'm basically having a discussion with myself here. I've written down some questions to answer, but, you know, whatever. Like, one of the things I want to get out of it, and one of the emergent themes from recent episodes of the show, has been what has changed since the pandemic, right? And what did the pandemic change in things, in music and in parties and in the industry? And if one of the things is that people are going out earlier and people are just generally paying less fealty, if that's the right word, to the established traditions, the established norms of the club scene, like, is that something that's going to endure? Because, you know, one of the obvious demographic things is that you had a generation of kids that didn't start going out until 2 years, best part of 2 years after they would otherwise have been. And they obviously picked up their own cultural baggage in that period, right? And are now bringing it to the rave. And, you know, that's fine, but it does have implications. And it's interesting to observe how these things manifest themselves in the kind of day-to-day of working in music. Anyway, there are a couple of other things I wrote down from Berlin. So in the gents' toilet, there was a sticker like just opposite at my eye level, which said like no borders. And one of the things which is emerging in the last few weeks, and it's emerged in, you know, it's been in my head for a little while, but the impact of the kind of global situation on the music scene and stuff like inflation and supply chain disruption and cheap flights becoming less available and potential for oil prices, therefore fuel prices, to be significantly higher going forward, and how that will impact what we do as musicians and what we do in the music industry generally. And so I've asked a few people about this. Talked about it to Ned last week. Had quite a deep discussion with George Fitzgerald about this and other stuff. That was a great episode, I have to say. There was a danger of it becoming a bit matey, because I'm sure many of you know that George and I are very good friends. I think we did a pretty good job of not descending into bro stuff. and particularly in the second hour of that, we had a really interesting, quite deep discussion about the potential development points for music based around stuff like that. And, you know, George was hypothesizing that this might have a knock-on effect for, you know, in terms of like local acts getting booked more often, sort of a similar sort of set of forces which sort of happened or threatened to happen anyway in the pandemic. But if it becomes prohibitively expensive to book an up-and-coming DJ from out of town, then that will really have a significant impact on how people build their careers, right? Because an important part of, or perhaps the most important part of building an artist's career in the last 20 years has been the ability to tour widely from early on at low cost and take your sound around the world, basically, from, you know, the first couple of releases that you have, or maybe you've just got a radio show or whatever, wherever's the kind of, you know, demand for you to play, and, you know, you're visible to everyone now, obviously due to the fact that everything is online. So that kind of like low barrier to entry in terms of access to your music and the low barriers to cost of touring, like if those two things go away, or certainly if the latter of those two things goes away, like that means it's that much more difficult. And yeah, maybe that means that you'll have more opportunity for playing in your own city, but like if that means that's all you do, then where do you go as an artist? Like if you have to have had a big hit record or whatever to make it worthwhile someone paying your much increased travel costs to get a show elsewhere, like that means it's much more difficult, much more, just it makes the whole landscape that much more challenging, I think, and that's much more difficult to build something for yourself long term. And if you think about it like that, we've really been in a really easy landscape for the last 20 years or so in terms of that stuff, certainly. So that's kind of scary, actually, going forward. The other thing about this weekend that I wanted to talk about was, yeah, playing on H-O-R with an umlaut. Yeah, it's kind of, they've caught an enormous amount of hype in the last couple of years. I think partly or mostly because they have an extremely easily identifiable visual hook, like the bathroom thing, as I mentioned earlier. And I mean, also they've done the stuff that you have to do, right? So they've been extremely consistent with doing lots and lots of content. I was trying to avoid using the word content then, but lots of stuff. And they're very consistent about the programming. You know, I've got a pretty good range of music on there, and you know, they it's broad enough, I guess, to draw enough people in, and it's consistently good enough to, you know, maintain their reputation musically, I guess. So that's all fine. The flip side of it, though, and this is the kind of Boiler Room effect, I suppose. Obviously, Boiler Room started this stuff, and the hook with Boiler Room was having people dancing behind the DJ. So it became, you know, the audience became a key part of each of the streams. And that's, you know, having a, you know, a memeable Boiler Room appearance has been one of the ways in which you can build a career. I mean, we had someone on the label, I won't mention who, maybe some of you will be able to guess who, but who really became a big act off the back of one Boiler Room appearance. And it wasn't because of the set. It was because one of the people in the audience were really funny and, you know, became a meme, basically. And the fact that the person in the audience was stood right next to the DJ meant that, you know, it rubbed off on them. So, and that's great. You know, there's nothing wrong with that at all. You take your break where you can get it, right? In anything in life, I think. So if a memeable dude on a live stream means that a ton of people listen to your music, then fine. That's absolutely fine. But it does sort of like beg the question, like, at what point does the visual side start eating the music side? Is the slight problematic area when talking about this stuff? Because, you know, in the run-up to me playing my set on Her this weekend, literally no one asked me what I was going to play. Like, musically, no one asked me, not a single person. Or, you know, have you got any new tunes for it? Have you made any new beats? Like, what's going on? Instead, everyone asked me what my viral moment was going to be. Like, that was the only question I fielded. And it's because, you know, those things have just become such a huge, like, point of reference for people. And, like, there's the bathroom hits sort of side channel to it, and all the kind of stuff that goes on around it. And there's been so many people who have made a sort of performance art performance out of their appearances on Her. And as I said, like, that's completely fine. I'm not being snobbish about this at all. But, big but, like, it is supposed to be a music show, right? So if the visual side has completely eaten the music side, like, what does that say? Well, first of all, what does it say about the music? I mean, that's a damning indictment, really, of what's being played. And, you know, what does that say to us about, you know, what we expect from our musicians? Like, are they musicians anymore, primarily? And this is one of the things that I've scratched my head about a lot. And it's very easy, as someone who's been around for a long time, it's very easy to be dismissive of developments. And you have to catch yourself and say, well, hang on a sec, no, this is just how it is. This is what people are vibing off now. And you need to be open-minded about it. But it is difficult. And we've talked about this. There's various different elements to this. We talked a little bit about it with Danny Days, and he's been quite outspoken about the sort of developments in this sort of thing on Twitter. And like, we kind of had a discussion which included a kind of, we talked about the diversity thing, which is sort of adjacent to this. And, you know, I've kind of decided that I don't really want to talk about that stuff anymore, because it's just quite a boring conversation, and you have to be so careful with what you say about it. Which on the one hand is fine, and I understand why people are sort of touchy about it. I understand that as a white guy, I'm in a position where I, you know, I should be watching what I say about certain things. And that's fine. I accept that. That's cool. But it does mean that it's difficult to have a proper conversation, an intellectually honest conversation about a topic. And I think that issue has become one of those things for me. So, I mean, that's an aside. Anyway, so I played my set and I wanted to say something about my set, actually. And this is just about music. So putting to one side what I've just been saying about the increasing irrelevance of music, if you like, well, those of you who followed my musical output since 2005, which is when the first Scuba record came out, I have had a kind of love-hate relationship with dubstep and bass music. Let's call it bass music for reasons which regular listeners will understand. So I was part of the early dubstep scene, and my move to Berlin, which I've now mentioned twice on the show, to be consistent, my move to Berlin was really partly motivated. I mean, I said earlier that it was motivated by money, but it was also motivated by the desire to get out of the London dubstep scene, which had just blown up in the previous year. And I'd been, you know, I'd been part of it, you know, going to the nights, but also releasing records and, you know, running a label. Like Hot Flush was, there was a year during the development of dubstep where everything went really quiet. I think it was 2004 or five. It was 2004 and everything went really quiet. And it was like, it was the year that Forward nearly stopped because there was no one coming. And Garage was really dead. We talked about that with MJ Cole, actually. And by the way, sidebar, that MJ Cole episode has been the most popular one that we've done so far, and it was great. He's a really interesting guy, and we had a great back and forth about various things. That was awesome. Anyway, 2004, which was the year his second album came out, I think, but it was certainly around then. And that Garage was just on the floor, and, you know, dubstep was still nascent. And Hot Flush was basically the only label still releasing regularly, like basically in that year. So we were definitely part of that early dubstep thing in a big way. But as we said, as has been covered on the show, I think it was the Joe Nice episode, like I'm not from South London. I'm not from Croydon. So, you know, I'm not part of that group at all. And I know those guys, they're all great. I mean, and I, you know, get on well with them, but that's not me. So the kind of emerging narrative of dubstep was it was a Croydon thing, right? And that became to me like a bit frustrating, frankly, that was just the received wisdom of all of it. And it just became a little bit suffocating. And I wanted to get out of it. I was getting pissed off with the music, and I was just like, I need to do something else. So that was a big motivating factor for getting out of London, in addition to the fact that it was super expensive. So my first album came out the year later, and the title of it, A Mutual Antipathy, was a direct reference to that, my relationship with the dubstep scene. Triangulation, which came out 2 years later, was kind of, I guess, like the kind of total of my musical efforts to that point. Like everything that I'd done in bass music kind of built up to that record. And, you know, there's a reason why it's popular. It's because it's probably, or certainly of that kind of stuff, it's the best work that I've done probably to date. With that record, it reached a point where I was like, well, I want to do something else now. I've done what I wanted to do in this style, basically. Which is the worst thing to do when you have a successful piece of art. What people want you to do is replicate it again and again. And that's a smart thing to do, right? All the big successful dance acts, electronic acts, have got a very definable sound, and they basically do it again and again and again. And that's true whether it's from dubstep artists to bass music artists to house artists to whatever, you name it. I could name some names. I'm sure you can name some names in your head, whether it's, you know, someone who made a dubstep album in 2007 or, you know, a famous band who first came out in 95. So I took the decision to do something completely different after my successful record, even though obviously success is a relative thing. It was successful for me. So I wanted to do something different. And I did. And I spent, you know, 5 years making house music. And actually, I was more successful doing that than I had been with anything else. But, you know, lots of people didn't like the fact that, lots of people who had liked triangulation and my previous stuff didn't like the fact that I was doing that, and I lost a lot of people along the way. And, you know, I've been kind of reckoning with that ever since. And, you know, what I then did was decided that I wanted to make techno. So I did that, even though I'd been sort of like in and around techno with my techno slash dubstep stuff since 2008. But, you know, I spent a long time just doing the techno circuit, which pissed off loads of people. Pissed off is probably the wrong word, which just lost the attention of people who had been into my house stuff. And, you know, that's another thing which, you know, is not a good idea. I wouldn't advise people to do. Anyway, this is a long way of saying that the set that I played at Her this weekend is kind of the... I've been trying to put together a sound for a while now, a long time, that I can be like, that it makes sense with that triangulation thing, but is up to date and is fun for me to play, and I can get away with playing at techno parties. So the reason for those three things are, the reason for all of those things are basically that I like playing techno parties the most. Those are the raves that I like playing my sets at. Absolutely. I don't like the whole bass music rewind culture thing. I hate all that stuff. I can't stand it. I'd really, you know, occasionally it's fun playing at that kind of party, but I cannot do the circuit like that at all. So I like playing at techno shows. I want to play faster. It doesn't make sense to play house. You can't play, you know, fast and big bassy drops and stuff at house shows. You've got to be much more understated with it. So basically what I played is the closest to the kind of sound that I've been trying to get for a long while now. It includes a bunch of new music that I made recently or over the last few months, unfinished stuff, mixed together with, you know, music from friends, and also, like, you know, just, you know, this sort of faster, kind of groovier techno stuff which is coming out now. Basically influenced by Truncate, basically. It's been clear to me that he's a super influential producer, that guy, on lots of people. But anyway, long way of saying that's a set that I'm happy with. And we didn't have a viral event on the stream, unfortunately. Although I did nearly make myself one by accidentally spilling a whole bunch of water on the floor and then sliding about, trying not to fall over, and actually very nearly falling over on more than one occasion throughout the subsequent 40 odd minutes of the set. It was nearly bad. Or maybe it would have been good, considering the potential benefits to be had from a viral event. I'm not sure that slipping over on your face is a good viral event. You just look like a dick. But then maybe if you just own it, you can get away with it. Maybe. Anyway, so that's all good. I've been rambling on for a long while on the subject of this weekend. I didn't mean to go on for quite this long. So just a quick recap on the episodes. I mean, like I said, there's 19 of them, so I won't go through each one. But obviously we've had mostly DJs and producers, like artists, whatever. But regular listeners will have heard me banging on about the fact that this is not just a DJ show, it's not just an artist show. So we're trying to cover various different angles of the music industry, and particularly our part of the music industry, it's kind of electronic part, but not necessarily limited to that. Anyway, so we've had, as mentioned, Nicole Cacciavillano, who's a super important dubstep promoter, bass music promoter from Denver in the States. I played for her earlier this year as well. She's great, and her insights into the development of that sound in the US, in North America, was super, super interesting. And we're able to kind of juxtapose that with Joe Nice, who is arguably the most important bass music DJ in America. So his episode, which went on for, that's the longest one we've done, actually. That was like a 3-hour episode, which included the best part of an hour at the end of it, just talking about racial politics, which was really, really interesting. And Joe's a great guy with just a huge knowledge of so many different areas of life, actually. Like he has an encyclopedic knowledge of music, but also I've never met anyone who knows as much about sport, different sports, as Joe Nice. Like any sport, he will be able to tell you just unbelievable levels of detail about any aspect of that sport, seemingly. And also, he's extremely educated and knows almost everything about, you know, politics and political philosophy. So that was an awesome episode. I love that. It was great. We had Rich McGuinness from the Warehouse Project, amongst other things, in Manchester. That's a very famous party. If you're listening outside the UK, you might not be familiar with it, but if you're in the UK, you've almost certainly heard of Warehouse Project. It was super interesting getting his take on growing up in Northern Ireland during the Troubles and the effects that the acid house and the early rave scene had in mellowing that really bad part of Northern Irish history and sort of laying the foundations for the Good Friday Agreement. And that was something that I didn't anticipate when I started the show, to be able to get insights like that. That was absolutely awesome. And also on the topic of acid house, we had Dave Clark, and that was an episode which was super popular too, almost as popular as MJ Cole. And in fact, while I remember, I've got to say shouts to Sebastian, the lighting guy at Aiden. He came up to me and said, "Oh, I love the podcast." And it's funny because, I mean, just going back to the music thing, like, no one has come up to me and said, "I like your music," for ages. I mean, obviously there's people at shows say, I'm here to see you play, so obviously I like your music. But people compliment me on the podcast way more than anything else that I've done for so long. So that's nice. Anyway, he mentioned that he liked the Dave Clark episode, which is the reason that I mentioned that here. And the Dave Clark episode was one where we talked about lots of peripheral stuff to music too. So there was a fair bit of politics chat in that, which was highly enjoyable. Dave Clark is a very interesting guy and someone who is unafraid to say what he thinks about stuff in a fairly unvarnished way, which is quite rare these days. It really is rare. And in fact, you know, as I've been moving into getting people who I don't know or asking people who I don't know to come on the show, it's really common to say, "Oh, come on, can I have a list of questions, like, in advance?" And, you know, no, you can't have a list of questions, I'm afraid, because it's a conversation, right? I'm going to have a sort of broad agenda and I'll give you the agenda, but I'm not going to give you questions. Afraid not. So the other one that I should mention is Melissa Taylor, because she's the only PR person that we've had on thus far. And the conversation I had with her was great. That was one that I don't think I would have been able to have with someone who I didn't know. Like, I go way back with Melissa, and we get on well, and it's easy to have a kind of good-natured disagreement with someone like that. So we definitely went back and forth on some things which I probably wouldn't have done with someone who I didn't know. So that was good. That was extremely interesting, in fact, on the topics of... In fact, we had a good back and forth on diversity, actually. And yeah, I think I've said all I want to say on that topic, as mentioned before. Anyway, the other development we've had since the last roundup episode was doing Patreon. And if you're listening to this feed, you're not a patron, because one of the benefits of being on Patreon is that you don't get the hard sell stuff. So let me just tell you why we're doing that and why it's good and why you should, if you can, sign up there. I am doing this, like I said, like, it's basically a hobby, this show. I mean, it's kind of something that I've done because I'm interested in talking to people about various different things. I mean, that's the most obvious thing to say ever about something. But, you know, there's no, like, business plan for it. It's not a way of making money. And yet I'm spending, like, roughly a day a week doing it. And despite the fact that it's not for making money ostensibly, or primarily, you know, I do want to have the biggest audience possible for it. So the main pods will always be available free to air. Like, I'm not going to pay all that. But, you know, I want to build the audience, and we have to do that through advertising, basically. So we need some budget. So the primary reason for doing Patreon is to get the adverts going, basically. Because that's, I mean, what I've learned about podcast marketing is that it's really quite difficult, and you have to have a budget. You have to spend quite a lot of money, and you have to be willing to waste quite a lot of money, or seemingly waste quite a lot of money. But so we need that. You know, I'm lucky that I don't have any setup costs. I've got a recording studio in my house, so I'm just sitting here in my studio now, rambling on. But the other thing that would be good to do would be to do video. That's the thing, which is the kind of big sort of sticking point now. And I don't know how I can do that for every time, because you need a set and all that kind of stuff, you know, really, to do it right. And, you know, my favorite podcasts are just audio, most of them anyway. Like, if you're familiar with the Bob Lefsetz podcast, and if you're familiar with Bob Lefsetz, but that is basically the template for this. I mean, I'm drawing back the curtain here a little bit, but really this podcast is directly influenced by that. But he interviews people from, you know, who are born 30 years before the average interviewee on this podcast. But I love it anyway. But it's that's audio only, so I feel justified in that respect. But if I'm serious about wanting to build it, then we need video, and that is definitely more of an investment, and that is something that we need money for. So basically, if you're enjoying the show and you want to support it, then Patreon is available. There's two tiers. There's one, just a regular support the show tier, but there are bonus bits of content that go out with that tier. And I'm going to be doing one this week, which is going to be a little bit of fun, I think. In fact, no, I am definitely doing it. Yeah. So that's that. And then there is a tier called Musicality, which is a bit more expensive, which basically gets you on the Hot Flush promo list, essentially. So it's everything we release a few weeks in advance in high quality download formats. So I think that's a decent offering. You know, as the community builds on there, we're going to potentially look at doing more stuff, for example, like Zoom seminars to discuss the issues talked about on the podcast a little bit more deeply. And we can have guests for those as well. So potentially we'd have a show which would be aired, and then a few days later we'd have a Zoom call with the same guest to talk a little bit more, take questions, that kind of stuff. That could be cool. But we need a bit more of a community on there to do that. So that's something we're looking at in the coming weeks and months. And we are pushing on, basically. There's plans for potentially doing live events as well around this. When I say live events, I mean, I don't mean like big hard ticket shows or anything, but stuff like, you know, at conferences and that sort of thing, potentially. So we'll see. We'll see how this develops. As I mentioned at the top, it's been a kind of see how things as they develop kind of process, this without too much planning, certainly in terms of like the content, in terms of like the discussion points and all that kind of stuff. There's a little bit of strategy going on now in terms of how we build it out. But like I said, you know, we are getting there slowly. Anyway, I think I've gone on long enough with this. I will be back next week with a guest for sure. And as I said, if you're a patron, then there'll be some extra bit of content, a bit more of me chatting, if this hasn't been enough, later this week. So yeah, until next time, I've been Scuba. Thanks for listening. I'll check you same time, same place next week for the next episode of the Not a Diving Podcast. Thank you.